You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Samantha Wright, filling in for Jemma Gaudette. And today on our Doctor Roundtable, we'll look at why you're likely going to get COVID over and over and over again, and what that means for getting long COVID. We'll also look at how many people with disabilities were hit harder by COVID than many thought. We'll explain how monkeypox is not COVID, and we'll ask the question, will kids under five ever get the vaccine? Here to break it all down with us is Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force. Welcome back, Dr. Pate.
Thanks, Samantha.
Don't forget, if you have a question about COVID, send us an email at idahomatters@boisestate.edu. Okay, Dr. Pate, let's start with this article. It came out a few days ago from The Atlantic, and the title pretty much says it all. You are going to get COVID again and again and again. And that seems just a little bit depressing. Can you tell us what they're talking about?
Well, it is. And of course, that's a generalization. So there, no doubt, is a significant part of the population that has already had reinfections. And it's more than what we have thought, because we've learned that our health authorities have made the definition for reinfection too overly broad. In other words, what they said was, we're not going to count a reinfection unless it occurs more than 90 days from the first infection. And there was some reason why that was a reasonable approach initially. But what we've learned is that the most common time for people to get a reinfection is when we have a change in a variant, as we're going through right now. And it's within that time period. In fact, most of the reinfections, it looks like, are in the neighborhood of 2 months, 60 days. So we just haven't been counting a lot of reinfections as reinfections. The other thing I would say is that certainly in my group of people, which tend to be people like me who have an appreciation for science and health and those kind of things, many of those people, certainly a number have been infected, but many of those people have never been infected. And in fact, most of my extended family has never been infected thus far. So if one does the things that we know helps protect against that, and if one exercises caution, you certainly are minimizing the chance. Now, plenty of people that have exercised all the precautions and still got infected, so that happens, but it's not invariable that we're going to repeatedly get infected. However, for most people who are under the impression that COVID's no big deal, I've had it, so I'm, you know, not going to get very sick if I get it again, and are taking kind of a cavalier approach to this, that group is going to get reinfected. And unfortunately, while early on there was a prevailing thought that if one had COVID, that a reinfection would be quote unquote milder, we have seen many exceptions to that rule. And we know that it can, in fact, be far more severe. In fact, the very first case of Omicron in the United States was a reinfection. It was in a man in his early 50s, and he died from that reinfection. So I don't think we should take it for granted. Now, what is the significance of repeated infections? Well, the honest truth is we don't know. So one thing is, well, could that cause physical harms to you if you're repeatedly infected? Because although there are some infections that we do tend to get reinfected with, for example, it's not uncommon for somebody to get influenza every 3 to 5, 7 years. So that happens. Certainly, we get reinfected with common cold viruses frequently, but we've never seen anything that I can think of off the top of my head where people can get reinfected 3 to 5 times per year. And this is a different animal. The other thing is, we know that this infection, even for those people that seemingly had a mild infection, it causes a huge amount of inflammation in your body, and it certainly can cause certain changes, particularly in the immune system, which are very concerning, that we don't know the significance of yet. Now, one of the biggest risks for those people that do get infected and survive is the so-called long COVID. What our guess is that because we've seen this in people that have mild infections, but then they develop long COVID, which is these persistent symptoms that can be quite disabling and can make it so you're not able to do the amount of exercise you did before, not able to do the amount of work that you did before, et cetera. It's very possible that it's kind of like pulling the slot machine. Every time you pull the slot machine, you have a new chance of winning that jackpot or winning something. And it could be the same way with infections, that it's just going to be a matter of, you know, is one of those particular infections going to cause long COVID? We still don't know why some people are getting long COVID, but it's not an insignificant number of people. So that's one worry. The other worry is the thing that I mentioned earlier, is that at least in some people, these infections can cause some challenges with system, so-called immunopathology, and we don't know if that's going to set people up that, yeah, they might have 2 or 3 infections that they might think are mild, but then all of a sudden they have one, and now they're in the hospital on a ventilator, maybe end up dying. We just don't know yet, and part of the problem is we don't know what variants of this virus we're going to be dealing with. What we have seen is that this virus, the rate of mutation, the rate of change is actually increasing. And now, while we had this change early on with Omicron, and everybody kind of concluded, that means that this virus is evolving to become milder, it's going to be like a cold. Well, that doesn't seem to be where the evidence is taking us at all, because now we're looking at BA4 and BA5, which started in South Africa, but now have just become dominant in Portugal. And we see it starting to take off in the United States a little bit. When you look at those have characteristics that are much more similar to Delta, and looks like we could end up with severe disease again. So for those that are taking a laissez-faire approach to this, I would just caution people, you know, we really don't know enough to know. It could be that it's not going to be a big deal, but boy, I sure wouldn't be willing to bet on that right now. And secondly, don't assume if, for example, if your first infection was Omicron and you had a mild illness, don't assume that's what it's always going to be, because I think that was the exception to the rule rather than the rule.
Wow. Okay. And I love the slot machine analogy, which is also depressing for all of us unlucky gamblers in the world. Let's move on to another disturbing article out yesterday that says the pandemic has been taking a bigger toll on folks with disabilities than a lot of people thought or paid attention to. Why is that?
Well, you know, I think, first of all, this won't be surprising to those who have people in their families that are disabled, and it won't be surprising to caregivers out there that are listening or reading that article that deal with the disabled, because we see this and we see the effects of these things on them. I have a family member who has an immune deficiency where, and it's not a rare one. I mean, it's uncommon, but it's not rare, where she does not make adequate antibodies. So you can give her all the vaccines you want, but she's not going to make those protective antibodies that the rest of us do. And so she really has to rely. We have one treatment available to really try to prevent infection in people like her. And she has to rely on that. But what we have learned is that with the constant evolution of this virus, it is very possible that one day that medicine will stop working to protect her as well, just like we've seen with the monoclonal antibodies repeatedly, how they work for a variant or two, but then a new variant and it no longer works. So, you know, I see the impact on her life. She's a professional. She's, she works full time, but she understands that if she gets exposed, this could be bad news in one of two ways. One is it could kill her. The other is that what we also see in immunocompromised people is it doesn't kill them. They just never get rid of the virus. And what happens is when that happens is that virus can keep on mutating in that person. And unlike what's happening with these random mutations, that virus gets to stay in that person for months or years. And it's a constant learning laboratory to figure out, well, how can it keep getting better and better, which is worse and worse for us, and then can get reintroduced into the general population and be a problem for us. The other thing about the disabled, there's lots of people with different kinds of disabilities, physical disabilities, other disabilities, and many of them are dependent on others for care. And as we have seen, for example, in our assisted living facilities, that the greatest risk to those seniors in those facilities was not their fellow residents, it was the staff, because they were young people who, in many cases, didn't get vaccinated, and they were living their lives outside of this skilled nursing facility or assisted facility, and they would get infected and then, not realizing they're infected, bring it into the nursing home or assisted living facility. And so we have many of those kinds of examples, whether those people are in aggregate care settings, congregate care settings, where they are living with a number of other people for the care, or even if they're still at home, but they require caregivers that have to come and visit their homes and help take care of them, which creates constant risk of exposure. So it's not surprising. And I think, Samantha, you know, I think this is just another symptom of what we see today. And that is really something that I've known is always there, but I've never seen it to the degree that we see today. And that is the amount of self-centeredness and selfishness of people that, hey, I just want to do what I want to do, and I don't care about others, but I want to be free to do what I want to do. And I am disturbed with the amount of sentiment of people that are not willing to do things for the sake of helping somebody else who's much more unfortunate or much more vulnerable. This is a really terrifying thought for the disabled community, because, you know, even though they're disabled, you and I might have a tendency to think, well, you know, they can't have a great quality of life because of their disability. Many of those people have very well adapted to their disabilities. Many of those people have had disabilities from early childhood or birth, and they've not known anything else. And they all have the same kinds of wants and desires that we do, and they want to live their lives, even if they have to live them differently. They are loved by family. They have children or grandchildren, and they want to see them. And so I think this is just some kind of, well, they're not as important as we are. We have to do what we want to do. And I think it's very sad, and I think it's very dangerous for them. And I don't think we realize in turn how dangerous we're making it for ourselves, because the more this virus spreads, including to disabled people or immunocompromised people, the more risk it is going to create back for us. So even if we don't have good Christian values where we want to look out for these folks, we should have self-interest that it's in all of our interest to control the spread.
Very good words there. A CNN article came out today titled "Monkeypox is not COVID." Why do we need that article to say that? And what are they talking about there?
Well, you know, monkeypox is, there are things about monkeypox that are very different than COVID, no doubt. There, on the other hand, there are some things that are similar issues. And so what I think I would tell listeners, look, you know, I'm a worrier. I have a list of things to worry about. You know, COVID is kind of in the top part of my list. Monkeypox is down in the bottom part of the list. But, you know, what I find as a chronic worrier is that sometimes those things, those levels change as we get more information. And I think what people need to understand is at the moment, there is no reason to believe that we need to be overly concerned about monkeypox. Of course, we said the very same thing about COVID when it started. And I don't think monkeypox will become anything near the degree of issue for us that COVID is. On the other hand, when you read things that people are saying, oh, you know, you don't have to worry about monkeypox because you really have to have close contact, you know, these kind of things. Understand what they're talking about is monkeypox 40 mutations ago. They're talking about what we knew about monkeypox prior to 2019. What's happening today, I don't know anyone that can explain. We've never seen this many cases occurring outside of Africa where it normally occurs that we can't tie to travel to Africa or to a specific exposure. Monkeypox is in 30 some countries. We think we have an idea of how this got started with some big gatherings in several places in Europe. But what we're seeing now is something much more akin to kind of community spread of monkeypox, which we've never seen before. We could always track and figure out, because I think last year we had two cases of monkeypox in the United States, and they both came from Africa and travel there. Our biggest outbreak was in 2003, but we could tie it to some animals we imported from Africa that are known to carry this virus. This is different. I don't think it's alarming, but it is different and it is concerning. And what I would say is when you hear people saying, oh, well, you don't have to worry about it because this or that, they're talking about the previous virus. Something has changed, either, as I've commonly said on this radio show when we've been talking about COVID, to understand how a virus is impacting us, you have to consider the behaviors of the virus and the behaviors of the hosts, in other words, the people that get infected. Something has changed with monkeypox. Nobody can tell you what that is just yet. So I don't want to say it's nothing, but it's not alarming either.
Gotcha. And one last thing that I saw on the internet that's going around, vaccines for kids under 5. Could that happen by the end of June?
Praise God, we think so. It looks like finally the FDA committee that evaluates these new vaccines is scheduled to meet in the middle of June. I think it's on the 16th. So I do think we have good cause for optimism that they are going to get approved for emergency use probably sometime that week, and that it likely will get a pretty speedy sign off from the CDC. I hope so. I'm expecting that, in maybe 2 to 3 weeks, we're going to be able to get those that are under five vaccinated. And what a welcome relief that will be to many parents who are concerned about these kids and who we really have had no other way to really protect them.
Well, I'm glad we got some good news in there today. Okay, so let's get to some questions. Sandra, Sandra from Haley says, I had the J&J vaccine in March 2021 and again in November. I'm a 60-year-old female with no underlying conditions. Should I get another booster? And if so, which one?
Yeah, so that's a tough one. We don't have a firm recommendation on people that have had two doses of J&J, as this person has. What we did come out with some recommendations is people that just had their first shot, they were recommended to not get a second J&J, but go ahead and get an mRNA vaccine. In her case, she's had two of the J&J, and her last one was in November. So we're going on, 6, 7 months now. I think, again, we have no recommendation, but I would advise her, talk to her doctor, because we need to give consideration as to whether, especially with some of the things that we're seeing coming at us, whether we ought to give her an mRNA vaccine dose now. I certainly would not give her another J&J, but the question is, should we go ahead and give her an mRNA vaccine? So talk to her doctor. That's where I would be inclined to go.
Gotcha. We've seen a few of these trickling off and on the past few months. Lori says, going out of the country later in the summer, have had vaccination and booster. Would it be advised to get the additional booster before my trip to Europe?
Okay, so she didn't tell us her age, right?
Nope.
Okay, it's hard to answer that without knowing her age. If she is over 50, I would certainly consider getting the second booster. If she's over 60, I definitely would get a second booster. I think what we need to be concerned about is what is her age? What are her underlying health conditions? And where is she going and exactly when? Because we need to be thinking about what variants they're dealing with. And for example, as I said in the first segment, if she says she's going to Portugal, well, holy smokes, now we've got a whole different situation than if she says, she's going to, Israel or something. So we need a little bit more information. I'm inclined to say yes, but we need more information. So please talk to her doctor.
Absolutely. And I think there's a lot of confusion out there about the second booster. We just got one from Bill. Should I get my second booster now at the end of summer or early fall? I know you have mentioned before that some people are timing their second boosters to waves of COVID to try and get a little extra protection. But I there doesn't seem to be just straight on recommendation as to when to get it, or is there?
There's not. And you're right. I get this question commonly, people trying to strategically time when to get their second booster, assuming that they're eligible for that. And to continue with our analogy of gambling from the first segment, you know, this would also be like timing the stock market, so which historically people are terrible at. So no, I would not wait for the fall thinking that, okay, that's going to be the best time. And the reason I wouldn't is two reasons. Number one is I think we're going to have completely different vaccines available this fall. There's new things in the works. I think we're all agreed at this point, these vaccines have served us very well, but we need something to deal with kind of where we're at now. So I think there's going to be wholly new vaccines for us this fall. And I think they're going to be better. And I don't think that getting a boost now is in any way that I can think of going to preclude us from being eligible to get that new vaccine this fall. On the other hand, I think people are not appreciating what's ahead of us. We are beginning a surge now. We're seeing BA4 and BA5 earlier than I thought. A lot of people are saying they thought that would probably be a fall surge. I'm not so sure it's going to be that long. So I actually would encourage people, get that second booster now if you're eligible. And let's just have in our minds that we're going to be getting probably a completely different vaccine this fall.
Good, good. All right. And we've got a couple minutes left. So Dee sent us this. We received some home tests from CMS, but they expired at the end of April. Are they still good? Good question.
Yeah, and we don't know, but the chances are yes. The big questions are how have you stored those tests? If you have avoided those tests getting extremes of temperature. In other words, you didn't leave them sitting out in your car where they got really, really hot, or you didn't pack them in a suitcase where they, you know, got into the, you know, kind of almost freezing temperatures on a plane or something. If you've had them at room temperature, had them in your house, if it's just been April, they're probably still good. If you're going to use them, the first thing I would say is, of course, get new tests if you can. But if you can't get new tests, then the key is when you do your test using that one that is now probably 6 weeks old, past the expiration, make sure that you get a good control line. That C on the test. Make sure that line that's supposed to be there regardless shows up good. If it doesn't show up, then don't use the test. Don't assume that test is reliable. If it shows up, that's going to be a good sign and it's probably okay.
All right. Lots of good information today, Dr. Pate. We've been speaking with Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System, and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force. Thank you so much for helping resolve some of these questions and giving us good information.
Thank you, Samantha. And everybody be safe out there.
Absolutely. And if you have a COVID-19 question for our Dr. Roundtable, send us an email at idahomatters@boisestate.edu. We'll ask it next week. I'm Samantha Wright, filling in for Jim Agudat. You're listening to Idaho Matters.